Hello from the future.
Who are you? My memory has been wiped and I don't know.
It is Dan. And I am very tired. That's how you know it's the future and also the past and present.
Oh, yes. My favorite Christmas ghosts.
hang on one second. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to interrupt your flow, but I'm wearing the wrong headphones and I don't want audio bleed. I can't hear you if you're talking, by the way.
I didn't. You told me to hang on for a second, so I was hanging on, as you do.
All right, I'm here. I'm here. I'm back.
Hello.
I didn't really leave. I can. Hello.
For the first time. For the last time.
Sounds like a song lyric.
No, this is from Spaceballs.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that movie, I think.
Spaceballs is good. Sort of. Caveats. Asterisks.
Oh, you're talking about the insensitivities?
Yeah, a little
of
bit.
An era?
Yeah. Yeah. So
it was a different time.
Yeah. But, you know, we've solved all of our problems that we've ever had as a society. And we move forwards in time. Yeah.
It took us longer to get there than we would have liked. If we would have had some sort of clairvoyance back then when we made Spaceballs, we could have looked ahead and saw that those jokes wouldn't hold up quite so much.
Yeah, but that's not that kind of story that they're telling with that. I don't know why Mel Brooks never did a time travel movie, unless he did and I don't know about it. But
he hasn't done it yet.
I'm not sure he will at this point in his career. But that would have been a rich thing to mine. Time travel comedy, unlike Detention. Which, you know, is terrible. But
I haven't watched it in a really long time. I feel like I should watch it again just, you know, for grins. See how it holds up.
Yeah, go ahead and do that with your free time.
You got PETA in there, from the Hunger Games, and he does some dancing. And then Dane Cook's there.
Reason enough alone to watch it again.
And then there's that girl and then the other girl. Mm-hmm. Whose name escapes me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She invented calling it guac. Paycheck.
I do still occasionally think of that.
Paycheck is a movie. I never saw it. It didn't seem appealing to me at the time, and I believe it had some, let's just say, mixed reviews. And so I don't feel like I missed out on anything. But,
to be honest, I'm shocked it didn't grab your attention back then.
Well, what I didn't know was that it was based on a Philip K. Dick story, which I don't know why I didn't know that, but I don't know how much we've talked about Philip K. Dick. We've done Total Recall and some other things.
We've discussed briefly his litigious nature.
Not really his litigious nature. I think maybe you're thinking of Harlan Ellison.
Maybe I am.
Yeah, because Harlan Ellison is the one who's like sued James Cameron over Terminator and stuff.
There you go. Then he's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah. Philip K. Dick was a little more chill than that. But he had a lot of like really out there ideas. Mostly because of the drugs, I think, and paranoia and drugs.
What kinds? Anything good?
I don't know if I could even possibly list all of them in the span of this podcast. But he just did a lot of stuff. You know, it was the style of the time in the 60s and 70s. And he has some interesting things. Like, one of my favorite novels is Ubik, which is yet to be turned into any sort of motion picture or television show. And I fear the day that it happens.
That's a type of ballpoint pen.
Mm-hmm, yes. A spray paint can and a used car and like all kinds of other stuff. Cleaning products. Mm-hmm.
Fortune cookie, A Tree Falls in the Woods.
It's a very interesting book that I like quite a lot. But the other stuff he's done is a little out there, and I did not know about this Paycheck version based on a short story of the same name by Philip K. Dick. I should read it one of these days. I have, for some whatever reason, I haven't read as many of his short stories as I've read of his novels for, I don't know, maybe I feel like I want to sit down and like get used to something for a while, but you know, I should probably just read some more of the short stories. But I love me some Dick, so I should really look into it. But you know, this is one of the problems though with trying to translate that dick to the American audience is that I don't feel like everybody can easily handle this dick. I feel like it's not always easy for people to understand the twisty, turny, futury, turns out stuff that happens in these. Minority Report is another example of something that's very similar to this. In terms of like concept, not in terms of the movie. But you know, you have those things where things are just shifting. What is real and who you can trust, and how you can like have faith in time and things you've seen in your memories. That all plays a part in all of Philip K. Dick's stuff, and so I feel like that's an important consideration when you are looking at a movie like this. Where if you're looking for a more straight up action movie, you may be disappointed by that. And I feel like if you're somebody who's looking for all the twisty turny stuff, you may be disappointed by the acting of Ben Affleck and Uma Thurman in this. That's, you know.
Well, you say it's not a twisty turny action movie, mm-hmm. Or straight up action movie. It would be a shame if they gave this movie to a straight up action movie director to create.
I think some mistakes were made. The second I saw his title at the beginning, a John Woo film, I was like, oh no, this is going to be bad. And that was even before I knew really all of the details of what was going to be happening in it. But I have to say, after watching it, I feel like this is the most normal John Woo movie I've seen yet.
In what way?
Just things don't feel as dialed all the way up to like really super crazy stuff. Like there's a ton of unnecessary slow motion and speed ramps, and
yeah, well, there's probably only, I don't know, you could probably count on one, maybe two hands the number of slow motion shots. Most of them are saved for the third act. You can't count the ones that are in flashbacks, because what are you gonna do for a flashback? You got to do kind of strobey weird color
effects. And you gotta make it blue.
It's gotta be blue.
And he does stuff with like freeze frames, like when he's taking out the stuff from the envelope. They hold the frames.
He uses all the techniques. You got your slow-mos, you got your strobes, you got your freeze frames, you got your blue frames.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, he does all of his signatures. There's exactly one dove in this movie.
One dove that is made entirely out of light wrap.
Oh, that dove looks terrible. But it's one of those things where it's like, it's his signature, and so it's in here, but there's one of them. And so I feel like
he only got one dove and one motorcycle. He had a little bit of restraint.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is like, it feels like it's his most normal out of all of them.
But at the same time, you're like, come on, John Woo, do you really have to get a dove and a motorcycle in here?
No, I mean, what other signatures are there? You got slow-mo, you've got dove, you got motorcycle, you have super wildly too close close-ups some of the mm-hmm. time with wide angle lenses and things, and you have
some of those like long angle long lens, like extreme parallax camera move kind of things.
Yeah, and also you've got the party that they go to at the beginning of the movie, where Ben Affleck is standing on one side of the string quartet, and he's ogling Uma Thurman on the other side of the string quartet. It's just like a Mission Impossible 2. Where
I was going to say the one with the dancer,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. it's like he's ripping himself off. And it's not like it's his greatest hits.
I mean, I wouldn't blame him if he kind of phoned this movie in a little.
I mean, by all accounts, it sounds like he did.
Paycheck, more like payphone.
Yeah, it's his, right? more like John Woo's paycheck. But there's multiple levels to that, because he got a paycheck for doing the movie.
Yeah, generally people get paid for movies.
Go figure. But
how close was this to Mission Impossible 2? It was a short 3 years later. So
mm-hmm.
He did one movie in between and one short film. Sure.
Yeah,
totally.
And it's his same cinematographer that he always likes to use, Kimball. So that explains a lot of very similar shots and camera work as well. Not just the director, but your cinematographer is the same. Now, something about the, according to Wikipedia, about the movie's reception, John Woo said, "I was fine with the sci-fi in Paycheck because there wasn't too much. I had intended to make an Alfred Hitchcock-style movie out of it, something more about suspense and thrills than guns and shooting. But unfortunately, the script wasn't written that way." It didn't work well for the suspense, and it didn't come out the way that I wanted it to be. Not as Hitchcockian. But at least there was nice. It was nice working with Ben Affleck. End of quote.
So what he's saying is that entire ending sequence back at the lab, he just kind of shrugged his way through, and then probably... he probably enjoyed the motorcycle chase scene, but not so much suspenseful.
No, and I have to say that the motorcycle stuff is probably some of the worst motorcycle stuff that I've seen from him. Especially the number of shots that they have where the motorcycle is obviously driving down the middle in between parked cars on either side, but they're trying to pretend that the cars are moving. But obviously that wouldn't be safe for the people involved. So... They don't linger on it for very long, and they cut with other shots of moving cars, but it's obvious. It is a motorcycle moving down parked cars. It feels really half-assed. And when you get to the stuff like in that whatever quarry junkyard shipping container place.
Yes.
And it's just like, this is not...
It turns into the A-Team movie, basically.
Yeah, it's just like, this isn't... Like, you wouldn't have this... place be like this, except you were setting up all of these things to happen. Like, oh no, he's going for the tunnel, and it's like, why does it have a tunnel? What's the tunnel for? How does that help him escape? You have a helicopter. I don't understand.
I would have enjoyed being there on set where John was like, all right, Michael C. Hall, look up from the helicopter because there's wires. Look to the right because there's stuff over there, and then. All right, cut.
Yeah.
We'll just cut that in somewhere. It'll be fine.
Yeah, the only thing I liked about the helicopter was the match cut to the helicopter blades, and that was the first helicopter shot when he's taking his ride to Seattle All-Com headquarters. And one thing I could never figure out about this movie is, where is everyone? Because it seems like they're all supposed to be in Seattle the entire time, but there seems to be a lot of travel involved. Like, why would you take a helicopter in Seattle? I mean, maybe he's on one side of the bay and needs to get to the other. They don't want to like commute through the city or something, but
yeah, they haven't implemented the gondolas yet.
Yeah, I know they just wanted the dramatic effect of your bad guy having a big old helicopter landing. And of course this movie is really shot in Vancouver anyways, so
oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tax incentives. Yeah.
I like how every building, every low angle building shot with like a foreground, you know, stone, I'm doing air quotes, sign with the name like FBI or whatever his financial institution was. It's just like a 6 foot wide by 3 foot deep cube of styrofoam sprayed with that sort of like dark gray stone texture, and then they just sort of stuck letters. I bet one side said FBI and the other side said the financial institution. They just kind of spin it around and they're like, we'll move the camera over here and you'll be able to tell.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's one of the things that filmmakers like about Vancouver is that it is nondescript in terms of the architecture, that it can play many places.
Sure, you just put a sign in the foreground that's like, this is your bank, and then it suddenly it's a bank.
Yeah, and so that is what they did. What I didn't ever understand is what was it called? Reedy Grant or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't necessarily understand their relationship with everything. Are they the company that he technically works for and is contracted out from, or do they work for Allcom and they are just contracted with Allcom and they handle giving people paperwork?
I think they're just a bank and or whoever manages stock for Allcom or something.
It was sort of odd, but I mean, it didn't really matter that much because we didn't really spend that much time with them.
Yeah, you just got the one confused lady with the big eyes.
Yeah, like, oh, yeah, well, I'm sorry to report you definitely signed this, and that's just how this goes. You definitely 100% signed it.
If I worked at a bank, I'd be like, here's a video of you signing it, because we have that.
Yeah, well, this is 2003. It is kind of funny to see the way they handle the future, because this is one of those movies where it's supposed to be, like, the near future.
Of course.
But it is... you know, it still in some ways feels late 90s, and in other ways feels very early 2003.
You know my thing about the early 2000s. It was a low point for popular culture. both in music and fashion and movies and just every bit of it. You look at it and you go, ooh, why are we doing that? Let's not do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, fortunately, we didn't use a lot of, like, contemporary music in this movie. But there are a lot of things in terms of, like, personal styling that feels very 2003. The messenger bags and the eyewear specifically feels very 2003.
Yeah, Ben Affleck wearing those sort of half aviators that are like two sizes too small for his face.
Yeah, well, and they were clip-ons, which is...
Oh, were they really?
Yeah, you could see the lower clasp on the bottom of the aviator. So they were clip-on sunglasses on his like chromed aviators that are like the squished kind where it's not the full 1970s like big aviators.
Mm. It's not a good look.
It's very specific. And Uma Thurman also has some bad eyewear. And then when he gets his like special can see through smoke glasses, those ones are also a little weird too.
I think those were intended to be jokey, but yes.
Yeah, because they also flip up. I think there was some weird kind of Oakley or Maui Jim or something. But the design of this movie, it feels very early 2000s. And they, you should look up, when was Minority Report was before this, right? Like a year before this, I want to say. Oh, yeah, it was literally a year before this, 2002. That movie felt more futuristic and advanced in terms of like near futuriness than this movie felt.
Well, it's because it was more blue.
It was a lot more blue. And it also featured like holograms and other technologies and things.
There's a hologram in this movie.
There is a hologram in this movie. And it looks very cheesy. And there's actually several holograms because this opening scene where we're sort of understanding the mechanics of what his job is, which I like because we get to be introduced to the concept of what he ordinarily would do. He's a guy, an engineer who has a bunch of skill, but you pay him to work for a certain amount of time and then you wipe his memory at the end of that time because he has developed a product for you. And then you want to claim that product without claiming any involvement for this from this guy. Like he doesn't own it or anything.
Well, and also because the products are so important and so secretive that a standard NDA is just useless. It's out of the question.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems weird because
it's extremely weird. It doesn't make any sense.
No, because especially with technology, it'd be like you find out like 3 months later. Oh yeah, there's a bug in this, and it's just like, well, too bad. I mean, and then
we erased the guy's memory. Sorry.
Yeah, and they sort of come to that. They have that problem in the film where he has programmed in a defect constructed, like stuck in a little plastic piece Lego defect, and that they can't easily solve, but that is one of those things where it's like, well, too bad we wiped his memory, so we can't fix it. And it doesn't seem like
you gotta have the guy in the lab coat fix it, and you better hope that before we erased his memory that Ben Affleck wrote up some sufficient documentation on the support docs.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it is very well considered in terms of
well, it's the CD gray market of multi-million-dollar contract engineering. They can't ask for long-term support from him because they're asking him to do very dangerous and illegal things. Which
it's a fixed bid.
Yeah, it's a fixed bid. Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the other things I like about it too. Is like this project I have for you is going to be 2 years. It's going to be 3 years, and it's like, okay, how do you know that? And how do you determine that the project will arrive at that point and you'll have a thing you want to ship or like appreciate or like or want to use at the end of that process? Because you don't really have any sort of safeguard on that. Do you get to extend the contract if it isn't working out? I mean, they talk about how in this movie, we can't do, anything longer than two. What does he say? Like eight weeks.
Yeah,
yeah, because that's the normal amount of time for zapping my neurons in order to get the stuff done. And he's like, no, we got a thing, and it's this chemical process. And that lets them do it for the 3 years or whatever it is that he's working for Alcom. And it's just like, okay, I guess, but like what happens if you need to extend? Like if you're on an 8-week schedule and then it's just like, oh, well, this isn't actually working. We're done with the project, I guess, but we need to like, we're not done with the project, but we need to zap the guy's brain because otherwise we can't reset his brain. And then do you bring in somebody else? Like, I don't know. How do you budget for that?
Maybe you just document it really well and then you erase him and then you let him rest for a couple of days and then you start over and he just gets up to speed real fast by reading his own notes.
Seems like a mess, but yeah, maybe. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. It's just the number of times where I've dealt with a producer who's been like, yeah, sure, it's going to be a day. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with the concept.
Delivery day is on Friday.
Yeah. Yeah. No extensions possible. We need to ship Friday afternoon. Yeah, sure thing. I don't know.
Suddenly they're at the dentist on Friday. You're like, oh, well.
I have a hard time buying the concept of doing this, but as like an actual profession. But one of the things that this movie doesn't ever clarify is who else knows this is a profession? Because he doesn't immediately tell the FBI that this is the kind of work that he does. But when he does tell them, they're like, oh, yeah, well, we've got our own memory chair doohickey thing. And so we can scan your memories too.
I think you mean to say we borrowed the prop from that other scene.
How do you like them apples? But he can't. They can't do
way,
it.
It's worth mentioning that there's nothing illegal about buying a product and taking it apart and learning how it works. Like, there's no reason that has to be inherently so cryptic.
No, I mean, the one thing I didn't understand at the beginning was why it was like he was like acquiring this thing, like surreptitiously. Why he was secretly acquiring this thing. It is weird because it's like you could just buy it, right? And then you take it apart and you reverse engineer it and you come up with your own thing, but.
You could be like, so the executives have plausible deniability about the origin of this idea because we're going to take their thing and we're going to make our own version because they obviously have patents on this because they released the product. So we need to make ours different, but do the same thing. But we don't want to know how he acquires the information. But it's like, that doesn't.
No.
That's not.
No.
None of this will hold up in a court of law.
No, especially the patent thing. I thought the patent thing was very confusing because he makes what is essentially a duplicate of the other thing. It seems a little clearer than even like the Samsung Apple case. Some copying happened.
But put the same holographic lady on both devices.
Yeah. She's a lady in a red dress. You can't own a copyright on that.
You can't have your startup chime be the same as a Mac if you're going to make a Dacintosh computer or something.
Yes. And he differentiates his product though by it being a hologram instead of a auto stereoscopic display doohickey thing.
Well, it's also a hologram, but it's a rear projected hologram, if that's a thing.
It's a screen hologram. It just doesn't need the screen. You can touch the lady.
He went from screen space to world space, you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's not a thing.
You transform the space. It's also, you know, goes uncommented on that he made a lady that you ogle based on the other lady that some other engineer made that you ogle. And then they demo your
product. The assistant guy pokes the hologram lady to see if she's a hologram or not.
Yeah. And then...
Great stuff.
And then afterwards, what's her name? Rita? Catherine Morris as Rita Dune. She's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, you did this thing and you're not going to remember anything. Why don't you just pour us some champagne? And, oh, no, here's the red thing I keep tied around my neck. Now it's not tied around my neck anymore.
That's
I did think it was kind of funny, though, when they're doing the memory zapping thing and the one guy turns over to Rita and goes, Jesus, Rita.
Yeah, she's like, oh, right, they can see the memories while they... delete them. Mm-hmm. That's not good.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just one of those things where if you got a sexy, like, engineer potentially losing his mind, you might as well have sex with him, I guess.
You saying it's Chekhov's hot executive assistant or something?
I guess. I mean, I also find it impossible to believe that Ben Affleck is the engineer that they,
oh, sure.
they think that he is.
He's got broad shoulders and he pushes out his lower jaw further than any human being ever should.
Oh, he keeps his mouth open so good through this entire film.
I'm writing that down, but I don't feel good about it.
Maybe he has difficulty breathing. I don't know. I'm not trying to like make fun of the guy, but he doesn't present as
engineer. He didn't even have a pocket protector for his fancy suit.
Well, I mean, he doesn't need to be a stereotype of an engineer, but at the same time, there was nothing about him that seemed particularly engineering. He seemed like an action star that fell into the role of being an engineer, which
he seemed like Ben Affleck circa 2003.
Yeah, and
which, for reference, I want to make sure we get this on the record. This movie in the Ben Affleck pantheon of films slots perfectly in between Geely and Jersey Girl.
Oh, but you are forgetting, sir, the other movies that he worked on in 2003, because it wasn't this one. Hold on, I need the
Daredevil.
And what was the other one? There was one more. I feel like in 2003
was not Surviving Christmas.
I thought he had like four movies in 2003 that he did.
2002 he was in the Jennifer Lopez Jenny from the Block music video. Oh, so there's that. Yeah. Wait, is Daredevil the one where he had the same hair but he had bleached tips or whatever?
No,
he had like. Oh boy, that's an unfortunate look.
Yeah.
Oh, it was kind of red-ish.
Mm-hmm. Because he was playing Matt Murdock, and he was pretending to be, he was pretending that he didn't have sight. His acting is something. But that's how he had a friendship with Jennifer Garner, which would blossom into a marriage, which ended in a divorce, which everybody knows about. But he's such a strange, strange, sad man. And I always think it's sort of fascinating the trajectory of his career, especially from like the 90s to this early 2000s string of flops, then to sort of like his redemption as sort of like a actor director, and then to things
you mean the Argo era,
yeah, and then things going back down again. he's really strange, he just doesn't really seem like anything other than sort of like a meat-headed doofus in this.
Does he seem interested in much of anything other than the Red Sox, maybe?
No. Although the Red Sox thing reminded me of that story that came out recently about Gone Girl, about how he refused to wear a Yankees cap.
It would ruin his reputation.
Yeah.
As being Ben Affleck.
Yeah, even though he is an actor in a role in a movie.
His fans are too dumb to know the difference. They're just going to be like, what's this Affleck doing wearing a Yankees cap?
Yeah. Oh, man.
I'm going to kick his ass when we see him.
Yeah. So he gets his Red Sox thing in here. And so this movie starts off with the thing of him doing this display and reproducing it and then getting his memory wiped by Paul Giamatti. And some guy bumps into the monitor and that causes the temperature of Ben Affleck's brain to go through the roof. And they're like, no, he hit 43 degrees and he's a vegetable. They only need that really for the other FBI scene. That's the only reason why this is in the movie.
Yes. By the way, 43 Celsius is 109 degrees Fahrenheit. So his brain was dancing just underneath 109 degrees Fahrenheit, which a little too hot.
Yeah. Well, that's what they're saying is like, you're going to have, problems.
42 is okay. His brain being 107 degrees is fine. Like, I'm pretty sure that's like vegetable territory.
Dan, I am not a vegetableologist or anything, so I just got to go with what they tell me in the movie. You got to believe Paul Giamatti. If he says you're gonna be a vegetable, you're gonna be a vegetable. And you know, if you mock over a monitor and it changes the temperature of someone's brain, then that's just what happens. They only really have Paul Giamatti to sort of like play this buddy role. And I think the movie maybe potentially would have been more interesting had Paul Giamatti been the star of the film.
And he had his dumb buddy Ben Affleck that came in and wiped his memory.
Yeah, because just recast that. But he has this sort of, how do I say this? This Paul Giamatti quality of being Paul Giamatti. And so when he's on,
he's a very aw shucks Paul Giamatti as well.
Yeah, when he's on the screen doing his thing, you're just like, yeah, I believe that you are 100% some guy that microwaves somebody's brain cells for a living. And
he feels like he's on Sesame Street, Paul Giamatti.
Yeah, he seems fine. He's, you know, nothing's weird or offensive or strange about him. You know, and he's not ranting about Merlot or anything. So
I was going to say, he seems like the kind of guy who might appreciate a Merlot.
Yeah, he
and a bucket hat.
The hat. The hat's so bad, but it needed to be for the line of dialogue. But the weird thing with Paul Giamatti is he's just like, oh, your reflexes are getting slow. Like, you need to stop doing this because you're eventually going to, like, really screw up your brain. And he's worried about that. And Ben Affleck is like,
look
nah.
How bad you are at using your stick to hit these light up posts, which won't come back to be useful later in the third act.
No, I was actually kind of pretty upset about that. I was just like, you're only doing this because he's going to beat up at least three guys with a stick later. And it's dumb. It doesn't make any sense for testing somebody's reflexes. But you know, whatever, movie. Use it to justify how this scientist turns into an action hero. And so that's how they try to do it. But Paul Giamatti also accompanies Ben Affleck to a party that's being thrown by Aaron Eckhart, who I also don't really like, just as an actor. I don't know if he's fine in person or anything, but you know, he's who you cast when you want a chin in your movie.
he's in this movie. He is a chin and an entire bottle of hair gel.
He is extremely Aaron Eckhart in this
his
movie.
His hair is glued to his skull.
It's the style of the time, I think, sort of.
I don't know about that. You're just like, why? Why did you feel the need to make it so low profile?
Yeah, well, they were probably like worried that you didn't want to compete with the height on Ben Affleck's
Maybe
natural
it's because
hair.
All of Uma Thurman's you know, Harmony remote controllers that operate wind turbines and stuff. He wanted to remain aerodynamic in the lab while he was walking around.
Yeah, he seems like somebody who's really concerned about being aerodynamic. But so he has this whole thing of this party thing, and that's where where Ben Affleck first meets Uma Thurman, and it's through like the weird string quartet thing, Mission Impossible 2, just like we talked about. And he goes over and he's like, what do you say we ditch this party and just go have sex? And then she says, I'm going to be over here if you want a real conversation. And, you know, don't give up so easily. Come over and try again. And that was weird because it'd be like, you should just reject this person. They're very strange. But whatever. Ben Affleck goes to go talk to Aaron Eckhart in his private smoke lounge in his house thing where he's throwing this event. And
which is the first scene in this movie where smoke detectors become a plot element.
Yeah, and the only reason why they need to do that again is because of the FBI scene that'll happen later.
I really don't think that needed to be a callback.
No, it didn't. But they wanted to have, I think, something for why smoke detectors would go off, but it doesn't explain why the super ultra mega lockdown thing happens in the FBI office when that happens. Because I can't.
You mean you light a cigarette and the halon system goes off and suddenly everyone's blind?
It doesn't seem like that's really how that would go down. But you know,
is somebody smoking a cigarette or is a server on fire? We don't know. Fire the halon system.
Yeah. And so anyway, he has this weird cryptic thing with Aaron Eckhart, who is not at all the villain of this movie.
He's got crazy eyes.
Yeah, who has a strange fortune-telling crystal ball in his private office thing. And he has a voice assistant named Isaac. And he asks Isaac to turn off the smoke detectors. The importance of predicting the future comes into play because that's what the crystal ball is, LOL. And then later on, when Ben Affleck is contemplating whether or not he should take this job, he looks at a palm reading porcelain hand that he keeps in his house.
It's like one of those skulls where it's like, this is the section of your brain that does whatever, but it's a hand.
Yeah, and it's just marked up with all the palm reading stuff, and it's just like, that's a little heavy-handed, if I were to say so myself. I would have gone for something else. You don't need to literally have your character look at something which is what they're thinking about, or what the theme of the movie is, or what the actual plot point is. Like, I don't feel like you need that level of connection.
Well, I mean, for a movie that basically recites riddles over and over again until the audience already knows what's happening next, it's on par.
Yeah. I mean, this, it seemed pretty obvious to me, not just because of the fortune-telling hand and the crystal ball, but because of things that had to do with the future, that it was going to be about predicting the future. But they really don't seem to come to that conclusion very quickly in the course of the film. But he agrees to go to do the Allcom job because it's one last job and then I'm out. That old chestnut.
I guarantee you 8 figures.
Mm-hmm. And stock options, you know, stuff. And so he goes to Allcom and he has that shot with it was him and the what are they called? Medicine balls that he's twirling in his hands, and that turns into the match shot of the helicopter rotor hub thing. Mm. And then they land at Allcom, and Aaron Eckhart's like, let's just go into my office. And yeah, this is how this works. We're going to give you an injection from this not at all creepy guy named Colm Feore, who plays John Wolfe in the movie.
The bad guy from the Riddick movie.
Yeah. And he was also the doctor in Face Off.
Oh, right. Yeah, of course.
This is his second time working with John Woo, maybe? And so he's there. And he's like, I'm not at all creepy about how I'm going to wipe your memory with this injection thing. So he agrees to do that. He gets the injection. Things go blue for a second. And then he gets a tour. And in the tour, he's introduced. Oh, and his personal effects were taken by Colm Feore when he was taken into the building. And they were put into an envelope. And they were going to be given back to him as if he were a prisoner at the end of this process. So he goes on his little tour, and wind tunnel thing, robot hand, he is introduced to Uma Thurman, who runs...
Yeah, some scientific flirtation with a lady with a robot remote.
Yeah, she apparently runs their typhoon hurricane plant testing lab.
Yeah, she's a biologist. Why wouldn't she have wind?
Why not? She's just studying the sturdiness of those... lily pads, I guess.
Is kelp the ones that have the big long things underwater, but they're not underwater here?
Well, they're in those acrylic tubes. But then in the flat, like couple inch thick ponds that are on the sides of the room, those have lily pads in them. So it's just like a completely random space. But they tried to make it feel like a Jurassic Park lab, kind of, with a bunch of people bustling around doing things. And it's just like, what would anyone be doing in here? Like, you're not building anything. You're just like, what are you going to do? Like, measure the temperature difference on each of the individual lily pads? Like, I don't know what their jobs could possibly be. You know, I guess it's just Silicon Valley bloat for you, although it's Seattle. So it's, you know, whatever. But, so anyway, he does the thing, and then it's just like, all right, now we're going to introduce you to your partner, who is this other guy who doesn't really matter. And then we're going to open this case, and then Pulp Fiction style, blue light. And then he's back in the office, and he's...
Hey, now, Pulp Fiction used gold light.
It was the light. That was the reference, was the light out of the suitcase.
Light in a briefcase. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he gets his memory wiped back, and this is the end of that process, and Aaron Eckhart's like, oh, well, that all went great. You'll get your money at the end of this thing. Yay.
He's grinning not at all like a psychopath. It's been 3 years. It went really well, obviously, because it always goes well when Ben Affleck's involved.
Yeah, and then Ben Affleck's all disoriented about it, and he leaves.
He's like, go home, rest. We'll call me back. We'll hang out. We'll get another cigar and we'll catch up. And I'll tell you what happened in the last 3 years that you missed on, I don't know, Will and Grace or something. He goes home and he looks up the stock symbol for the company, based on how many shares he thinks he owns. And he's like, look at me. I got $92 million. I'm gonna go get my $92 million. So he goes to the bank lady people, And the lady's like, here's your bag of crap. And he's like, this isn't my crap. And also, where's my money? And she's like, no, you gave your money up and you sent yourself a bag of crap.
Yeah. And
he's like, why would I do that? Why would I give up $92 million for a bag of crap? It doesn't make any sense. And she's like, sir, this is an Arby's. What are you doing? Take your bag of crap and get out of here. This is your signature.
I actually kind of like that scene. Ben Affleck, while he is not a believable engineer, he's believable at being upset about, you know, why would any human being do something like this? So he leaves. He goes home and he gets abducted by the FBI, who tase him. They could have announced themselves as federal agents rather than breaking in and shooting him with a taser, but
And they strap him to a chair that spins around, but it's got a little foot pedal to stop it for dramatic effect, and then restart it up. And even Ben Affleck's like, what are you doing here? Where's my lawyer? And he's like, well, you don't get a lawyer, because this is what happens when they say Ben Affleck is a real bad dude and ruined my morning by telling me I gotta go arrest you and stuff. So turns out you're so important that we're going to keep you, I don't know, in like the FBI version of Guantanamo Bay, which is just a silver room in the backside of a building that he can easily escape.
Yeah, and they have the envelope of things that they got from Reedy Grant or whatever it was called, and they're going through that, but they don't really understand what everything's for. And they're asking him about it, and he's like, no, you can't. And they're like, you refuse to help. And he's like, no, you don't understand. My memory's been wiped. And then they take out the thing, and they're like, oh, yeah, we're going to zap your things. And they're like, oh, this doesn't make any sense. Oh, no, his brain's getting too hot. And it's like, oh, well, shucks. And then he goes and he lights up
Miles Dyson's like, you know what? I need a cigarette. And the guy behind the table's like, hey, take his. He won't mind. LOL, because he's got a brain fry. And then he lights up a cigarette indoors. And he's like, oh, no. I accidentally set off a smoke alarm because I forgot that people don't smoke indoors because I'm an idiot, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the reveal of the mechanism that plays us through the rest of the movie. Because Ben Affleck trips and falls out of the chair that short circuits itself or whatever, and he puts on his Halon glasses, and he can see through the Halon. But his bag of crap that he mailed him are clues that he could sneak out of the place. He's circumventing his NDA, which is very inadvisable, legally speaking. But his bag of crap leads him from point A to point B to point C all the way to the end. Because he could see the future with his future device, because he doesn't yet know what he invented. He just knows a guy's name, and he knows there's lasers and mirrors and optics. And then also Einstein said if you had a strong enough laser mirror, you could look around the curvature of the universe and you could see yourself in the future and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, just the kind of conversation you have over a casual lunch with Paul Giamatti at a train station.
Yeah, well, I mean, that wasn't part of that conversation. That was the head of the DOJ or, yeah, Attorney General Brown, played by Peter Friedman. He is the one who broke it to Joe Morton that you have the curvature, this laser goes around the universe and you can see to the future.
Oh, that's right, because he's kind of a little bit of a bit player in this movie, and they gave him a very dramatic thing to say, and he was not quite up to the task in that scene.
Nope. He was definitely not up to the task. It is pretty disappointing what he does in the film. It doesn't seem to make any sense in his involvement.
Where he's like the head of the FBI, and he's like, we gotta stop this, and then he's like, great, we got the machine, kill Ben Affleck. Mm-hmm. Wait, we lost the machine, find Ben Affleck. Like, What is guiding your decisions here?
Yeah, it doesn't really work out. But the important thing is Ben Affleck gets out.
You kind of expect him to like turn over his hand and have like a ring for like a secret organization who's like, ah, we're the time Illuminati sent to protect all machinery from being able to travel through or see through time. We've been around for a millennia and we're written in scripture and we are the national treasure of a movie four.
Now, see, he wanted the device for himself. He represents in the film the newspaper headlines that are on the micro dot that Ben Affleck looks at later.
Micro dots, remember that?
Yeah, wow.
That used to be a plot point.
Yeah, also really crisp in this film, I gotta say.
Yeah, I love the when they cut to the shot of him like moving the envelope in the microscope, and he moves it like an inch and a half, and then on the screen it's just this nice smooth move that moves like half a millimeter.
Yeah, very very realistic. But the they basically are representing two things here: the capitalist stuff, which will, you know, stop at nothing to know what the future is, so that it can manipulate it for capital gains. And then you've got the government stuff, where it'll stop at nothing in order to manipulate things for power and control and the theoretically safety. And so those are the reasons why Ben Affleck can't trust either of these people, not just because one of them was shooting at him and the other one didn't identify themselves as federal agents before they abducted him, but, you know, just because it could result in bad things happening. Although at this point in the movie, he doesn't really know that it is the future or anything. He just knows that he coincidentally was able to get out of the FBI headquarters using this bag of tricks. And he runs across Comfiore, who is eating a slice of pie at a cafe nearby, because apparently they had used the machine to see that Ben Affleck gets his brain toasted as part of this interrogation process at the FBI, but that doesn't come to pass because Ben Affleck makes it out of there, and so his brain is untoasted. And Comfiore is a little freaked out by that.
Just like New Yorkers prefer.
Yeah, and so he goes back. He's from Boston. He goes back to...
It was a bagel callback for the audience.
But Comfiore goes back and talks to Aaron Eckhart, and Aaron Eckhart's like, what were you doing? What did you do that changed all of this? And
oh, wait a minute. If I'm here and you're there and neither one of us changed it,
yeah,
then that must mean Frankenstein is the old prospector.
But my favorite line reading in the entire movie is when Comfiore has to say, I was eating pie.
Just as the Oracle prophesied.
Yeah, I wonder if that was actually in the thing. And they're just like, nope, got to eat the pie now because we saw it in the thing. So, you know,
yeah,
that's what you got to do.
You know, if you predict somebody's future, they don't have a future. Mm-hmm. Did he choose the pie, or did the pie choose him?
Yeah, also, what if he ate the pie wrong? What if he started with the crust end? Or what if he,
oh,
you
God.
Know, that, that whole thing.
Do you think he specifically stopped and set his fork down in that position because he's like, well, this is what the video looked like. I don't know why I would eat half a piece of pie and then put my fork down perpendicular to it across the plate.
Yeah. I don't know either. Maybe he ordered the wrong pie. So anyway,
there's not really a wrong pie.
No, they're all good pies.
Yeah, it was cherry pie too. It made me want pie, honestly. Yeah. Mostly because I didn't care for the movie so much.
But they, Comfiore's a little freaked out by this. Aaron Eckhart's freaked out by this. They don't know what to do. And Aaron Eckhart goes to go use the future machine, and then he can't use the future machine because of system error 41.
Error 41, yeah.
Yeah, and they go down.
Oldest trick in the book.
that old chestnut. So he goes down to the thing, and they look at all this stuff, and the one scientist they haven't killed or brain wiped says, oh, yeah, so he must have, he did a virus, but you don't understand it. It's a physical virus. And it's just like, that's not a physical virus. He made a physical defect in it. It's not a virus. It doesn't make any sense. Whatever.
You know what happens if you just put random circuitry in motherboards as like a physical virus? They usually catch on fire.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it didn't matter because it was like a little, like, I don't know, it was sort of like a clear plastic plug that fit into the otherwise seamless board.
Right. It was basically just a jumper that basically said, skip this little bit of circuitry and send error 41.
Yeah. It was one of those things where, though, I when you see what it finally is and you see how the rest of the board is constructed, you're just like, how did that guy not find that after like looking through this board for days, all of these boards for days? But whatever. So they can't use the future machine to see what he's doing or what he's up to or what he had looked at in the past. So they're all freaked out now. And
which, I mean, you would think if they were smart that they would save their past future recordings offline or whatever for easy access, like save them to the cloud or something.
Yeah. And also, I don't know, maybe check your future machine before you try to kill the guy. But they seem pretty confident in the predictions of the future machine. So maybe they were overconfident. And the scientist guy says that he can definitely 100% solve the physical virus without Ben Affleck's help. It's just going to take a couple days.
Right. This is the first time in the movie somebody's like, we don't need him anymore. Kill him. Yeah. Wait. We need him anymore. We need him. Hang on. Don't kill him yet. Capture him.
Step one, we kill. Step two, we don't kill. Step three, we kill. Step four, we don't kill. But so anyway, they're going after him. They're going after Ben Affleck. And Ben Affleck's like, I don't know what to do. I'm on the run. I'm going to meet up with Paul Giamatti try to talk to him and figure out what's going on, why about all this random stuff and what all the random stuff does. And when he's there,
he sees his key to the utility closet. He sees his fortune cookie that tells him that he can predict the futures because he sees the TV with the lottery numbers. And he's like, holy crap, I predicted the lottery numbers. This is how I know what I was meant to do at the thing. And then suddenly there's everybody shooting at him and they got to escape and stuff.
Yeah. And he's able to escape because he knows what was going to happen. Although if you knew it was going to happen, why did you get yourself in that situation? But whatever.
Yeah, he helped himself escape, but just narrowly.
Yeah.
Like, he's at gunpoint, but like, you know, he's gonna sabotage the train so it stops and blocks the guy from chasing him. But also he's going to fall down and almost get run over. Whatever. It's a John Woo movie, so you got to have your suspense and things. But, you know, he trips and falls his way through everything. He uses the paperclip. He gets his way out of there. Maybe it's just I've lost my taste for these kinds of movies. But, you know, halfway through his packet of goodies, you're like, you know what? Can you just like tell me what all the things are? Like, I don't want to watch you have that look on your face while you discover what these are for. Like, oh, my matches. There was a fake cover. They were painted and it washed off and it said the restaurant. And I called the restaurant. They're like, you've got a reservation. And then coincidentally, Uma Thurman's like, oh, there's the steam in my bathroom. Tells me when to meet my Ben Affleck boyfriend. And then we're going to meet up. But Aaron Eckhart's on to us. And he knows Ben Affleck doesn't have his memory, but he might have a little bit of a memory. So just in case, we're going to find a fake Uma Thurman and make her look blonde and blue-eyed with a computer program, which I don't know if that was like Amazon where he was like ordering blue contacts for the lady or whatever, but like he's designing her eyeballs to be blue and he's like, yes, perfect match. Pushes the return button very hard, but it's just like, did you just order contacts from like the utility closet downstairs to be sent to her or something? I don't know what you're doing here.
I think that it could have been more interesting than it was. And I have to admit, there is a level of fatigue with the narrowly escaping situations by barely figuring out what every one of these random things does.
Ben Affleck running kind of confusedly into a set piece and going, wait a minute, and rummaging through his pockets and pulling out a thing and going, aha, this must be the key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is just got a little too cute. Particularly towards the end, once they get to the BMW dealership and they're looking for a motorcycle, looking for a BMW, and Uma Thurman deduces that it is a motorcycle, and then they go out of there. I do like Ben's line of look for a BMW, and then Uma Thurman says, "You got to be kidding me," because they're in a BMW dealership. But this the whole thing is like they. They barely get out of every situation, which is why it's suspenseful. But at the same time, if you could see the future, why would you want to barely get out of every situation? I don't know. And also, how do you know?
Yeah, why don't you do a, Bill and Ted, remember a trash can around every corner and it falls on everyone's head. And then you just run away real easy.
Well, and also, if you haven't had access to this future machine since the first time that you used it prior to having your memory wiped and composing this package of goodies, how do you know that you doing these things will produce these outcomes? How does he know that that is what the future will be from this? Because if he's looking at it, then the paradox would be it isn't his future anymore. So he's changing it.
Is the assumption that because the future machine has been down, that nobody else has been able to look at the future since he left, that it's unchangeable?
Yes, except for the fact that he's changing his own future on the fly. So how would he know what these outcomes are anymore? Like there is no longer a control group. Like he has changed something, and then he's changed some more things, and then he's changed some more things after that. There's a sequence of events.
It feels like he watched it like every single day for his last couple of weeks, and he's like, "Oh, they got me there. I better put a paperclip in the bag for this part." And then he watches it on playback, and he's like, "Oh, they got me there. I better put the BMW key in here." He's like, "Ah, okay, they got me there." So he had to watch it over and over and over again, and every time he dies, and then eventually he watches a version where he gets out of there.
That's possible. Although I don't know why he would leave it at the last recording being the one where he looks like he died, but he didn't really. It seems strange as a motivating factor, but maybe that's what they needed to do in order to actually win the thing at the end.
You see, that's how time paradoxes work. He did everything he needed to do exactly when he needed to do it in order to get it to go. Even the things that looked like mistakes had to happen for a reason.
But anyway, I mean,
you can't just Bruce Almighty God mode your way through a whole movie. That'd be boring.
No. I mean, and I'm not suggesting that he effortlessly glide through this, but
that'd be pretty funny though.
But the fact that he is narrowly escaping all of these situations where there are armed conflicts that go on for a protracted period of time, where there is more randomness that is introduced from like gunfire. Like, is any possible thing that you could have done going to change the way that gun fires? Because you don't know, you can't go double check.
First of all, zip tying a bullet to an actuator, not an actual way to set off a firearm.
No, I mean, this is, I feel like I've seen this a couple other times in films where they're just like, we're just going to put a bullet here and then this thing will hit it and then I'll make the other thing happen. Sort of what it feels like. And another thing is when they talk about the stuff that he had mailed himself, they're like, oh no, he just put in all these innocuous things. And it's like, a bullet's not an innocuous thing to mail to yourself.
Unless it was like a keychain. They made it look like a keychain.
Yeah. And Comfury,
at the very least, they would have been like, innocuous or not, these are not the things you showed up with. What are you doing?
Yeah. Oh, and also Comfury, I mean, he probably wasn't like personally checking all the mail and whatever. And that was a problem. But he said at the beginning that all mail that he receives will be screened. So Ben Affleck bought a BMW motorcycle online and had the keys shipped to him to pick up at the dealership. And the key is what wound up in the envelope. So who was screening his mail and not noticing that he was buying a BMW motorcycle? As a normal, 100% absolutely boring thing that a human being does.
Maybe they were like, I don't know, he wants to have a vehicle when he gets out of here and uses his paycheck. What's no big deal to us?
I mean, that's the only possible explanation I can come up with.
Your first instinct wouldn't be he's buying a getaway car for things that have yet to happen.
No, that's true. So, you know, this movie... Unfortunately, I don't like the chemistry between Ben Affleck and Uma Thurman because it doesn't exist.
It's a little rough. They try. Mm-hmm. They do try. I mean, Uma Thurman is giving it her all when Ben Affleck doesn't recognize her and they used to be in love. And, you know, look at these photos. Although every time that they showed like the photo album of the two of them together in happier times, all I could think of was like the one day on set where the photographer was like, all right, now you hug her like this. And then kiss her forehead. All right, let's take that picture. All right, now look like you guys like each other. I'm gonna take this picture over here. Like it looked even the photo album didn't have
now
fake chemistry.
Hold the birds. Hold the birds.
Yeah, hold the birds. Look at the birds.
Yeah,
we love the birds. They're family.
These birds are important to this plot. So anyway, they don't have chemistry, so you don't really buy the romance. And because you don't spend any time with them as a developing couple, you don't have any heartbreak when Uma Thurman has that reaction.
Saying you weren't in love with them as a couple from the very beginning when he hit on her poorly and then they had their wind tunnel moment in the lab there, and he's like, oh, shucks, I don't know if I want to take this job because I just met a cool girl and I'm going to forget who she is.
No, I mean, I do like that we don't see their relationship, because then we don't really understand what he's lost, or what her feelings are, and she has to explain them to him as if we, the audience, are also having that explained to us. Because otherwise, I think it would be a little frustrating if you knew about their relationship, and how they were actually like really loving beforehand, and then we had some of that before the memory wipe happened. I think that would be kind of annoying to watch, because then you'd be like, of course you love her, dumb dumb. But the way that they do this, unfortunately, I think the issue is that when Uma Thurman and Ben Affleck are together at the end of the movie, you don't really buy that they are, that they have the chemistry to be together, like this. And I don't know who's necessarily to blame for that. I think that these two actors just don't gel together. Maybe they liked each other just fine on set or whatever, and they were friendly and things, but like they just never seemed like a couple in the process of this film.
Yeah. I mean, especially imagine them now, knowing what we know of them, of their work since then.
Yeah. And also,
can you imagine Uma Thurman and Gone Girl, though? That would be kind of interesting.
I haven't seen Gone Girl.
You gotta friggin' watch the movie. Can't wait for, you know, who to read the damn book.
He said he was going to read the book many years ago. He's still
not going to have it.
Still hasn't read it.
Just tell him it's movie night one night, and then don't tell him what it is, and then just put on Gone Girl.
I think he would protest a little.
You think he's going to get up and storm out and be like, you know what, I have to read that book first.
Well, he may not do that, but he may be like, this movie's too long.
Well, that is accurate. I think that, if I recall, it's a long movie. I don't really remember.
But also, you know, Uma Thurman as a biologist, we've seen her do it better. We've seen Poison Ivy.
Poison Ivy was the better biologist,
I guess.
I mean, she probably had a more realistic plan for saving society.
Yeah, she's gonna repopulate the Earth with her little puppet plant. So anyway, I just don't buy the relationship. And when they're working together as action heroes at the end. I know that Uma Thurman can be an action hero, so it only feels weird in the fact that this character shouldn't be an action hero, and her commitment to performing action on screen, particularly when she throws the motorcycle helmet in just such a way that it bounces off the hood and into the cop's face and makes him makes him ease off the gas and then stop his car in the tunnel, like, that's a little bit of a stretch. I'm not saying she can't be talented, because I think it makes it more interesting than just having her like walk around and hit people over the back of the head with a vase. But I find it strange in the ways that the movie chose to depict her as being completely competent in action scenarios, just randomly, because we see no other evidence to reinforce that in her career as a biologist.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
What are you going to say?
Yeah. And so, anyway,
she's got a really cool jacket that covers her whole neck for some reason.
Yeah, and then her messenger bag.
Of course.
And they go to a high school because it's just so happens to be across the street from where they're renting a room.
That was my favorite shot in the entire movie, where he's like looking at the envelope in the apartment, and then he looks up and looks off camera, presumably we're meant to believe it's like a window that he's looking out of, and then he just like takes a step towards the edge of the frame and we cut, and it's just like I can hear the direction of like, all right, now look up, look to the right, you're having an idea, take a step and cut, and then we'll figure out where the next location is next.
Yeah. And so then they go to the high school and they use the thing to figure out the stuff, and Ben Affleck talks about, you know, how this leads to nuclear war, and then they show probably the worst CG nuclear bomb explosion I've ever seen in my entire life.
Even bother to go like, wait a minute, which city is that?
Oh, I think it's LA, but the explosion itself is terrible. It is obviously just over this photo that they're panning, scanning over, but the explosion is sort of semi-transparent and has these sort of like quantized edges of things because they tried to seemingly color correct it 20 ways to Sunday in order to make it try to sit with the plate, but it doesn't. And it just looks so pasted on top. It looks awful. I don't understand why that needed to be in the film. You could just show us the Photoshopped thing of a nuclear explosion happening. You don't need to be like, you know what? I'm going to pretend to be James Cameron and show you a nuclear bomb going off to make you feel bad about the ways in which the future of the world could unfold. Because you don't have the budget to do it in this, apparently. This is a rather thrifty film.
What was the budget? I didn't look.
$61 million.
Oh, that's pretty ambitious for $61 million, especially with all the sets they had to build.
Yeah, I would say that they just overshot what they were capable of doing. I think they should have just recognized that that didn't need to be in the film in order to make you understand that he had fears about nuclear bombs going off. The sum of all his fears. And so they they shout at each other.
Doesn't one actually go off in that movie, though?
I'm not sure. I never actually saw The Sum of All Fears.
You know his entire catalog, but you've never seen it.
I mean, yes?
I'm almost positive in The Sum of All Fears, a nuclear bomb does go off.
Okay. I don't know. Know your enemy. So, anyway, the thing with the thing is that they talk about what the ramifications of this are and their plan for breaking into Allcom as they're walking through a high school hallway full of students all around them. And it's one of those situations where it's like the director said, okay, now you're going to walk through this high school hallway and it's full of all these kids because they're cheap. And we're going to just cram them in here to make it feel like there's a bustling whatever going on in the world. And it just doesn't seem like it's a conversation you would be having under those conditions. But they decide that they're going to go to Allcom and they're going to break in there and do the thing. And he's got the ball bearings, and that's what they use for the metal detectors, and they can use the badge to get into the door.
It's so stupid. They're like, we see him. He's here. Oh, no, he set off all the metal detectors and caused chaos. It's like, but you're looking at him. Just follow him.
Yeah, I mean, they could have just captured him, but Aaron Eckhart, for some reason, is like, no. Let him do exactly what he wants to do, because then I'll capture him. And it's like, yeah, okay.
Don't let him know that we know that he knows that we know. So he's going to go in there, and he's going to fix the machine. I don't know why we assume he came here to fix the machine rather than do something worse to it. They just assume that he needs to fix it so he can use it again. They don't assume he's going to destroy it, which is partially true. He does fix it,
yeah,
but he also blows it up.
I also don't understand why he fixed it. To be perfectly honest with you, I was like,
he fixed it out of like curiosity. He's like, did I really make a machine that could see the future? Like, let's see the future.
I mean, I guess that's the kind of thing you probably want to double check since your brain can't really be counted on. But at this, yeah. At the same time, it's like, this is also exactly what all of the people in the movie want and will cause the bad thing to happen.
Right, we need to see him watching the footage of himself getting shot so that Uma Thurman can be all sad when he's like, no, this is my destiny, go on, be free or whatever. The callback to earlier in the movie where he's like, if I told you it wasn't gonna work out, would you still want to be together with me?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, whatever. Romance triumphs time.
I did like the blood on her hand that seemingly came from nowhere.
Where did that come from? Wait, we have a glass separation here. There must be blood on her hand.
Yeah, it's just like, it doesn't seem like she had an injury. She doesn't seem like she touched anybody with an injury. But for whatever reason, she's got blood on her hands. And so
it was either that or they were going to do the Wrath of Khan thing.
Yeah. You have been and always shall be, my Uma Thurman. And so they do the thing, and then he goes to go to the lab room to fight Aaron Eckhart, and instead he like has to fight all the other bozos, and then there's a secret government scientist who's been in there the entire time who doesn't look even remotely suspicious.
I love the part where the giant like foot and a half thick concrete door, he sabotages the thing and they can't get in, never mind the fact that they just blow up the keypad which opens the door up, but there was a man-sized air tunnel vent leading to the server room underneath. Just like move the louvers and you can get right in.
I mean, It's just how you design your really secure rooms, is that you just have something that somebody could just crouch down a little to walk through. Not even like crawl, but crouch, just crouch.
Crouch through the air ducts? That's impossible. Nobody would ever do something so crazy.
Yeah, and
there could be a fan in there maybe, but there isn't.
I mean, it's held on there by all of two screws. So yeah, that was all the security you need. But they,
somebody would have to go and find like a pipe wrench or something heavy to hit it, and then it would come off.
Yeah, and so the lab fight is dumb. He has the stick, and he hits the people with the stick, and there are four armed guards with guns, and they all fall down like they're, you know, friggin' like Power Rangers goons. And mm-hmm. So he faces off with Eckhart, and after he lets Uma Thurman out, and then Aaron Eckhart's like, I'm gonna fight you with my bare hands, because the future that Aaron Eckhart saw from the repaired machine is that he shoots, or someone shoots, Ben Affleck up on the catwalk. On the catwalk, he does his little shooting up on the catwalk.
Yes, thank you for that. Yeah. I appreciate
and,
that.
And so, for him to drop dead, they're going to need to go up to that second level, and to do that, Aaron Eckhart needs to take the optic fiber braided rave cord thing out of the wall and like wrap it around Ben Affleck's neck kind of loosely, because it's braided so heavily that you can't actually corrode him with it. And then Ben Affleck quasi wraps it around Aaron Eckhart's neck and then somehow uses that to like flip them both. And it's like one of the most like Captain Kirk Gorn fight scenes that you've seen in a John Woo movie. Like I thought it was just supremely lazy. I don't know what they were thinking when they were going through the process
of
doing it.
Affleck. It was all in the eyes and the chins. Everyone's just glaring.
Yeah. And then so Aaron Eckhart wins enough to get the optical fiber braid tied up to the lift thing to take him up on the little gondola up to the catwalk. On the catwalk, he drops him on the catwalk, and then Aaron Eckhart hops down and he's like, aha, now to shoot you with my gun, like how it was meant to be. And Uma Thurman is there now. She's been abducted, but that wasn't what was in the future memory or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then Uma Thurman says, oh, don't you believe in second chances, because she sees the government agent guy. And then, despite the fact that this was not what was in the future thing, his Casio wristwatch thing or wired watch or whatever it is goes off finally, and says go
for a solid 10 seconds before they're like smiling at each other and jump off the catwalk, because apparently they're fast enough to jump out of the way of a bullet. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so he legitimately must have been watching a playback from one of the pre-new bag of tricks mailed to himself future recordings, because once he mailed himself that watch that had a preset alarm on it, he changed the future. But he must have also seen that too, because he must have known that like he didn't have a tantrum at the bank or whatever and smash the watch and ruin it, so he wouldn't have his alarm go off, or like sleep on it wrong, so he accidentally snoozes the alarm or something.
Yeah. Anyway. The government guy
should. I hate how much thought we've put into this.
Your neck hurt. And Aaron Eckhart falls off and he hits the ground, a la Ben Affleck in The Thing, and he's dead. And then Comfiore...
Well, he's not dead. He's on top of the glass ceiling there, mm-hmm. with a bullet in him. But I think he's alive just long enough to be exploded.
Yeah, because then Comfiore is over in the other room, 30 feet away, and he's like, oh, I guess everything's under control. I'm just going to dick around with the future machine. He sees his own future of exploding, and then he explodes, because it's right when the piston goes off, because that was the ticking clock, so to speak, underneath him. And that fireball consumes 10 feet of the set, and then they set up for the wider explosion shots, and then it consumes more of the set, and then they set up for the wider explosion shots, and then it consumes even more of the set.
Well, you blow up the liquid hydrogen, so it goes all the way over to the liquid nitrogen, so it goes all the way back over, whatever, it's just a chain reaction, which is another movie we shouldn't talk about that has science and dumb people.
But, yeah, so it's just one of those movie things where an explosion... is very small scale when you're very close to it, and then also takes forever because you have to make it look like it exploded the entire thing. But in reality, if you had blown up a bunch of liquid hydrogen tanks, it would have just all blown up at the same time. Not like in like a series of stages, but you know, this is filmed on a series of stages, so why not? And they, you know, are able to get down the clear shower curtain and to safety.
Of course.
Aaron Eckhart is consumed in fire, and Confiori is obviously consumed in fire, like he saw in his future. And the machine's all destroyed and stuff, and all the government agents who were streaming into the lobby just in not the nick of time arrive. And
the attorney general guy is like, dang it, they blew up the machine. Did you find Ben Affleck? And Miles Dyson's there, and he sees Ben Affleck's watch on a lily pad, and he's like, oh, he escaped, but I'm not going to tell my boss because he's a jerkwad who wanted to kill Ben Affleck, and that's just not right.
Yeah,
so I'm gonna wink at Michael C. Hall, and we're gonna share a secret together now.
I don't like what they did with Joe Morton. I feel
they gave him some unusual facial hair.
I also don't like that either. But I don't like what they did with him because at first he's this I'm gonna break all the rules and take you to justice because you're a treasonous person and destroy you. And then it's just like, oh no. I mean, he could have been bad, but he wasn't. He didn't mean it. He didn't mean it when he destroyed all those cop cars. He's just, you know, he's just trying to live his truth. Like,
I'm a man who marches the beat of my own drum, and so does Ben Affleck, and I respect that.
Yeah, I don't understand. I don't understand the pivot. I don't understand any of that. And Michael C. Hall doesn't really have a character that he's playing so much as just a person who is on screen who says things.
He has a peculiar affectation in the way he speaks, and he wears a suit.
Yeah, I also talk about a lot of gel. So he's there. Doing that, brushing up for his Dexter role, and they're lamenting the destruction of this thing. But well, it's if you know the future is safe because nobody should really know the future. That really should have been a conversation that they had with Joe Morton and Michael C. Hall, where they're just like, "Don't you think it's kind of messed up that we're trying to like get a machine that can see the future? Like, aren't there any ramifications of that?" But they don't really have that conversation. I feel like
That would be something that would create a more interesting movie. So
yeah, I feel like that could have potentially justified their actions, but they don't choose to do it. And then so we dissolve to Ben Affleck being sad garden dad, throwing those bags of I don't know mulch, dirt, whatever, over his shoulder to his time. Yeah,
He's making it look very difficult to lift those bags of fertilizer.
Yeah, and then he's carrying him over to Uma Thurman, who's going through all the orchids with the light beams, the god rays shooting in through the windows. She's like, oh, it's a good thing that Paul Giamatti's character, Shorty, I had to take a second to remember that his name was Shorty in this movie. It's just like, just call him Paul Giamatti. Like, just say, oh, yeah, it's a good thing we're taking care of Paul's orchids. Because, like, it didn't matter that his name was Shorty. But he you know, he wasn't doing such a good job with all these plants. It's a good thing I'm a biologist. And, you know, Ben Affleck says, you have a green thumb. And then she says, more like a gangrene thumb. LOL. And then Shorty. Paul Giamatti shows up with the birds in the bird cage, and he puts it down, and he's just like, you know, I went through a lot of trouble to get these birds from this thing. Nobody loves me. And
you guys couldn't do something that would make us a lot of money.
Yeah. And then Ben Affleck's like, wait a minute. I had that fortune on the fortune thing, and it said that I should look below. What's below a bird cage? And then he looks, and there's the lottery ticket that he apparently bought and shipped to himself, which you can't legally do, but whatever. And the lottery ticket is the winning ticket that we saw from the numbers on the fortune cookie wrapper strip thing from earlier.
And it just so happens to be right around $90 million, which is what he was going to make with the other thing before he gave it up.
Yeah, because and his reason for giving it up in the movie is he needed to give up the money so that he would pay attention to the clues. It's like, okay.
Or you need to trick yourself into thinking you gave up the money so you would pay attention to the clues, only to give yourself back the money later.
Also, I don't really know how you go about keeping a low profile and evading the government while also cashing a $90 million lotto ticket. But I mean,
if everyone at Allcom's dead, like, who's going to be the one to actually say, like, well, I guess the FBI guys would be like,
Yeah, I think I get that feeling that technically they should be on the run, but whatever.
Ben Affleck is dead. Uma Thurman, we're not sure where she is. Paul Giamatti, he just cashed this check for $90 million. It's possible that they're all still alive.
Yeah, I don't really find it to be a satisfactory conclusion to the events of the film, because it's just like, if they're on the run, it doesn't make any sense. But at the same time...
Yeah, but the footage is very sort of soft and glowy, and there's beautiful diffusion on the lens, and they all lived happily ever after.
Also, all their hairstyles are different, so there's part of me that's wondering, did they change the hairstyles to make it seem as if time had passed, or did they change the hairstyles because this is a reshoot of an ending? Like, did they have an ending that was a more of a downer and didn't test well? Like, I don't know. It just didn't really seem to mesh with anything. It just seemed like a little too happy ending for all of it.
I was just looking on Wikipedia. The only production notes are that the film features several of John Woo's trademarks, including two Mexican standoffs, the appearance of a dove, and a birdcage similar to the one seen in 1992's Hard Boiled. What? How is that a signature trademark? You didn't even mention the motorcycle.
Mm-hmm. I think
way to go, Wikipedia.
The motorcycle is a bigger trademark than a birdcage, but
yeah,
I haven't seen Hard Boiled, so you know.
I don't think I have either.
I am told it is one of his best movies.
Okay.
So I feel like I should see it at some point, just so I can be like, yep, see, I don't even like the best one.
Chow Yun Fat. I watched a Chow Yun Fat movie the other day.
What movie was that?
You're not on Letterboxd, are you?
I was, and then I fell off the wagon. And
yeah, me too. Yeah. I kind of forgot. I recently did. I watched Bulletproof Monk.
Oh.
Which features Chow Yun-Fat and Stifler.
I remember that. But that
Holy
is the extent...
Holy crap.
I never saw the movie. What you said is the extent of what I remember. I remember there were trailers for that as a movie, and I was just like, nope, not going to see it.
It's also got that one lady in it. It's got some of the most incredible, like... What year was this? Yeah, 2003 as well. Oh my god. Like, you've got your bad guy who, like, lives and hangs out in the sewers, who's got, like, spiky dyed black hair, and he wears, like, plaid long pants because he's, like, a punk guy, and he has, like, an Irish accent or British accent or something, and he kicks people and he uses a stick and stuff, but he's a bad guy. He's a mobster dude or whatever. And his name is, Mr. Funktastic is his character name, and he's a gangster. Mm. It is a horrible movie. Mm-hmm. Absolutely atrocious.
Isn't it some, like, sort of mechanism that Stifler has some, like, magic gold coin or something? Or some item?
No, it's a scroll. The Bulletproof Monk he's a Tibetan monk, but who has, like, ultimate power to, like, walk on air and kick people and stuff. You know, he can see through the Matrix or whatever because he has special powers that he transfers on to the chosen people. Jamie King is the other lead. It's a very bad movie.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good. So 2003, crap year for films.
Very bad period of time for the world. Mm-hmm. Anyway, paycheck is what all these people got, and then we funded it.
Sort of
made it happen.
Yeah. Man. What a bunch of people in this.
That is technically that's not inaccurate.
Mm-hmm. Doing stuff and things.
Doing stuff and things. It is 2 hours of stuff and things.
Oh, so the fourth movie that I was trying to remember that he did in 2003 was The Battle of Shaker Heights, where he was an executive producer. He was not in it. He just was involved in another movie project during that year.
I don't know what that is.
I don't know either. But yeah, the year before this, 2002, was The Sum of All Fears, along with Stolen Summer, where he was a producer, but not in it, Changing Lanes, The Third Wheel, and Speakeasy as an executive producer. year before that was Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Daddy and Them in Pearl Harbor.
Ay, ay, ay.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Affleck.
He has some bad films. A lot of them, really. But for some reason, people treat him seriously about his, like, filmic aspirations still. Huh. Curious.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, on that note of depression, I guess, of being really bummed out, being sad, Ben Affleck.
Thank you for tuning in, and thank you, Joe, for watching this movie. I guess, I don't know.
Yeah. I didn't really hate this movie as much as I thought I was going to. I honestly find Mission Impossible 2 to be more contemptuous in a way, and I find
it's just because it has Tom Cruise in it.
No, I have a different level of dislike for that movie than the other Tom Cruise Mission Impossible movies. But the way that one is made is awful. But the you know, and then you know, you got something like
Don't act like that Limp Bizkit song isn't a great song.
It is not. And then you got something like Face Off, where it's just like so ridiculous. It's so broad and over the top in all the ways that it can be over the top. And I just didn't like it. They didn't grab me. And then you got this, which is like pretty mediocre in terms of like it's what it's got going on. Like it's not swinging for the fences or doing anything really challenging. It is like, hey, we're sort of like a not entirely competently made action movie with a sort of sci-fi premise thing underneath that could be more interesting if somebody else had directed this, and it's cast with a bunch of randos who shouldn't really be working together in these roles. But for whatever reason, it didn't bother me that much. So I wasn't like mad at the end of watching this.
Well, that's high praise if I've ever heard it.
Yeah. I mean, I'd give it like 2 out of 5 stars.
Yeah.
It's not a 1-star movie. It's not a 1/2-star movie.
No, not quite. Mm-hmm. Didn't make you actually angry.
And let's make ourselves not angry and end the podcast.
Okay.